Brassell up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And this week, we have a great show for you. We're going to be talking to a writer and an artist for a brand new Voltron series coming out from Dynamite Comics called Voltron From the Ashes. It's coming out on September 16th. The first issue will be available and on sale on September 16th at $3.99. And you'll be able to probably get it also on Voltron.com as well as Dynamite Comics. So I want to first introduce the artist from Voltron From the Ashes. His name is Blackie Shepherd, and he is known for his comics and pinups, especially Blackie's Beauties, which he started with his own Kickstarter. He's done Vampirella, and he's a big, huge fan of Voltron, Shogun Warriors, and giant robots in general. Welcome, Blackie Shepherd.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for joining us today, Blackie.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
All right, I also want to introduce the writer of Voltron From the Ashes. His name is Colin Bunn. He's a writer, novelist, and short story writer known for Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe for Marvel, The Damned, and The Sixth Gun for Oni Press. He's here to talk about Voltron From the Ashes by Dynamite Comics, and his name is Colin Bunn. Welcome, Colin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, both of you.
Yeah, yeah. And if I could just to plug something of Colin's, he's also currently releasing a series called Harrow County that is probably the best comic I've read in the last 10 years. And I'm not just saying that because I'm working with Colin. I tell literally every person I come up against that they need to read Harrow County.
That's true. Let's keep talking about that. Well, thank you, though. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is that story about?
Harrow County, it's coming out from Dark Horse. It's an ongoing series from Dark Horse. It's sort of a Southern Gothic fairy tale. Lots of creepiness and horror elements, and all set in backwoods North Carolina circa 1930-something.
And how did you come up with the idea for that story?
I grew up in rural North Carolina, surrounded by ghost stories and strange happenings. And I just it's a story I've always, I guess when I think about the things I like and the things that kind of if I were going to say what Voltron's me together, for instance, it would be giant monsters and Micronauts and Shogun Warriors and backwoods horror. So somewhere, yeah. Somewhere in there, there's a backwoods Voltron story. Maybe, maybe that's the next thing we should do.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think we've ever seen one of those.
Right. I think we may be able to put one together. But anyway, it's just one facet of the things I like and the kinds of stories I love, and that's where that one, that's where that story it grew out of, those strange stories and strange happenings around the backwoods where I grew up.
Okay. All right. We've heard a little bit about Colin's background here. Now, what about you, Blackie? Where does your Blackie nickname come from?
It's an old family nickname. So my granddad was I come from a long line of Irish pirates on my dad's side. Right. And so, my granddad was a coal miner, and when he would come home when I was a baby, my mother and I lived with my granddad and my grandmother, and so he would come home from the mine and hang up his clothes, which were just covered in coal dust. So everybody called him Blackie. So when I'm 1 year old or whatever, I would grab his clothes and put them on and kind of run around the house and get covered in coal dust. So I've got this whole big chunk of my family that calls me Blackie. And then my last name being Shepherd, most of my friends growing up and all the friends that I made in the Army and that kind of thing, they all call me Shep. So nobody calls me by my regular name. Like, my mom doesn't even call me Chad. I rarely, my wife calls me Chad sometimes when she's mad at me.
Does she use the middle name too?
She has some colorful epithets that she breaks out for me, you know. I don't know what kind of podcast this is. I'd hate to throw this into the hard R territory this early in the podcast.
Right, but you also have a love for the horror, don't you?
Oh man, horror is so. I was about to make a joke that, you know, Colin and I must have both grown up, you know, in the backwoods of North Carolina during the 1930s, because I have a very similar kind of background. Mine was in Oklahoma during, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I'm a child of the 80s, pretty much. And for me, it was horror. I'm really into disturbing horror. Like, I saw The Exorcist when I was probably 8 or 9. And it made a huge impact on it. Didn't scare me. It just lit me up. You know, I was just, and I remember the first thing that ever drove me absolutely crazy. My aunt took me to see The Omen when I was 8. And there's a scene in The Omen, spoiler alert, when this photographer, played by the wonderful David Warner, my favorite character actor of all time, also of Sark fame from Tron, he plays a photographer, and he gets his head cut off through this, you know, very weird series of events. And man, I'm 8, right? And this guy's head gets cut off, and I go running from the theater, just screaming, freaking out. But the whole walk home, all I could think about was that dude's head coming off, and how did they do it, and, you know, the story behind it. And so, you know, I'm 8 years old, and I'm the world's youngest, you know, gore nerd, you know.
Right.
So I really got into horror. That was my whole childhood. I was into, like, making special effects makeup stuff, you know. So every Halloween, I'd buy a bunch of fake skin and fake blood and make a bunch of stuff and do all my friends up with horrible wounds. And so there were, you know, like, there were 3 or 4 houses that I wasn't allowed to play at because their parents thought, oh man, this kid is just warped, you know. But yeah, so it was horror, you know. Very early on, I got into H.R. Giger and Alien. Really blew my mind. And then The Thing was a big influence on me. John Carpenter's The Thing, his remake.
Right.
And then that, coupled with, like, Cohen, I immediately glommed on as a kid to the Shogun Warriors and the Micronauts as, for me, what summed up everything that was rad about science fiction when I was a kid. Right. You know, which you couldn't get two more kind of diametrically opposite IPs, right? There's Shogun Warriors, right, giant robots, and Micronauts, which are microscopic warriors, you know? So it's just, but, it, you know, I think what did it for me mainly was the comics. You know, I discovered the Micronauts, and I had, you know, a couple of the toys as a kid, but when I got the comic, Michael Golden's art and Bill Mantlo's writing, it was just that first, you know, 12 or 13 issues is just, you know, practically perfect.
Yeah, it is perfect. Just that is the comic that made me love comics was the Bill Mantlo Michael Golden Micronauts. And you know, wow. I feel like it, you know, and I've said this many times, I can pinpoint the issue that turned me on to comics. And I mean, I read comics anyway, but I can pinpoint the issue that made comics something special to me, and it was an issue of Micronauts. And you know, I love the entire run, but you know, those were those kind of comics. You know, this was, you know, these were toy lines, both Micronauts and really Shogun Warriors and ROM Space Knight. I think of that. This was when they didn't have Micronauts and ROM anyway. Didn't have, you know, cartoons that went along with them, and these were guys who were defining a mythology around, you know, Bill Mantlo really did both those books, Micronauts and ROM, and he defined this big mythology out of a toy line, and it was that world building that really hooked me on those kind of books. But yeah, you know.
You said you could pinpoint the issue that turned you on.
Oh yeah, it was the issue. I think it was issue 5, I believe, is where Man Thing shows up. I usually for some reason I get 5 and 7 confused, but so it was issue 7 with Man Thing, and the reason I can tell you so precisely right this second is because I have them all bound up and I'm looking at a edition.
I saw that.
Yeah.
I'm so covetous of your bound set. Wow. And,
yeah, I'm looking at, I got Micronauts and Shogun Warriors. I got all those bound up into hardbacks so that I could reference them whenever I wanted.
So good.
Colin, why don't you tell us, besides those comics, what were your, you know, inspirations growing up that turned you into a writer?
You know, I think a part of it is having a dad who was sort of a natural storyteller. He was the guy who was always telling stories and spinning tall tales and things like that. So part of it comes from that. I guess the things that you know, influenced me beyond that as a writer were, you know, one, the comics I was reading. So I was influenced in a big way by things like Star Wars early on, mm-hmm. and Micronauts you know, I think about this when I think of my kid and the things he does and he plays, and when he's playing, you know, he's not playing with action figures and toys the way I used to, right. Because there's so many other things that are distracting him, and, you know, things that he's interested in that weren't around when I was a kid. So when I was a kid, it was, you know, I was making up stories to go with my mixed collection of Star Wars action figures and mm-hmm. Micronauts and things like that were adventure people that I was, you know, creating these.
Adventure people. I loved those as a kid.
I was basically creating this new, you know, these stories around, and Shogun Warriors, all around these toys. I would just play with them all together and tell some new story about those characters. And I was just always wanting to tell those, you know, to tell stories. And, you know, as I got older, I got more into horror movies. I was doing special effects, and that was actually where I thought I was going to go. I was going to do special makeup effects, was my dream for a while.
Yeah, me too.
And that somehow turned into wanting to write horror stories. And it's just a little bit of everything. You know, I've just always wanted to tell stories in one form or another, whether that's prose or, you know, comics or whatever. And it all just comes from this steady diet of hearing stories and reading stories and, you know, watching movies and things that just kind of captured my imagination. And I just always wanted to be part of that, I guess.
Now, one of my favorite giant robots that I first saw was in the 70s. It was Johnny Sacco and his flying robot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I just, I was so, you know, just amazed by it, because it had this flying robot that was controlled by this little boy from his watch. And the robot flew, it held him in his hand. When it would fight, it would have all these different types of weapons coming out of his fingers. He had like an electronic beam coming from his eyes. I mean, there was all kinds of things, and it just, you know, kept me captivated for every episode.
Oh yeah,
and I even today I have all the episodes on DVD.
Yeah, Johnny Sacco was one I honestly never really. I think I'm just maybe vaguely aware of it. But in the 90s, I got back into Godzilla in a big way. You know, I found out there were all these movies I didn't know were being made. And I got back into Godzilla in a big way. And at around that time, I also got into Johnny Sacco. I discovered Johnny Sacco and got into that. And I'm probably more familiar. There was an anime called Giant Robo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That was basically a reinvention of the Johnny Sacco story, which I thought was I still love that. And the series, it was one of those shows that never had an ending. You know, it ended before its time, I guess.
Right.
Or at least I've never seen an ending for it. Or if that's the ending, it's the bleakest ending of a giant robot story ever. You know, it's one I still I love that anime. But I was a big fan of. Later in life, a big fan of Johnny Sacco, I guess.
Okay. All right. So coming up to Voltron then in 1984, were you guys able to see it when it first came out?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I saw it the day it aired. I watched it. I was sitting in front of the TV after school.
Yeah, for me, it came on before school. And it started, let me see, 84. So I was probably in fifth or sixth grade, I'm guessing. It was one of those things, you know, every morning you'd wake up, you know, and I'd get it together for school and I'd turn on, you know, the cartoons and, you know, do my thing. And I remember specifically the first morning that I saw Voltron, because it, anytime something new came on, one of the shows that I watched was Ultraman, right? I'm sure you guys remember Ultraman. And it came on right after Ultraman, and so I was so fired up for Ultraman. I was such a nerd for that. And so when Voltron came on, it came on at 7:30, and I had to leave the house at like 7:40 to catch my bus, and so I missed my bus, because I was like, I'm not leaving, man. This is rad.
This sounds like the same story that Claire Grant told me, that she would be
Oh,
late for
really?
school every day because of Voltron. And
I
she
guess
grew
I
up
was lucky.
in around Memphis, Tennessee.
Huh, interesting, guys. Yeah, it came on in the afternoons for me. And I remember in a similar fashion, the bus didn't drop me off until the show that came on before Voltron was Star Blazers.
Oh, I love Star Blazers.
And I always missed the first 15 minutes of Star Blazers. And I always felt like it was better for that. I felt like I was coming into something. First of all, Star Blazers didn't feel like a cartoon to me. It felt like something much bigger. There was a bigger story.
It was a
And
space
coming in,
opera.
halfway through every episode, I was like, there's something. I think the feeling that there was something bigger going on was always important to me. And
Right.
I remember with Voltron, I felt like I was probably a little too old in my mind, at the age I was, 7th grade or so. I felt like, oh, I shouldn't be watching this. Kids would be making fun of me if they knew I was watching Voltron. But
Right.
my younger brother was really into it, so he was my excuse. I'd always watch it, watch it because of him. He was really into it.
Right.
But yeah, I was watching it the day it the, I watched it the day it came on American TV.
Yeah, so
For us, anyway, I don't. It might have aired somewhere else in the country before then, but I remember the big day. It was.
Right.
I remember when it aired for us, anyway.
So in some regions they were watching it weekends, some of the regions they were watching it in the morning, and some at in the afternoons. It was also sort of a mix and match in the early goings with Vehicle Voltron and Lion Force Voltron.
That was what happened in my region. They would show, and the thing is they didn't show any of the episodes in any discernible order that I could remember. So it was, they would just like, Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday would be Lion Force, and then they'd show a couple of episodes for Thursday and Friday of Vehicle Force, but none of them were ever consecutive episodes. It was the weirdest thing, and so that was crazy confusing to me, because I kept thinking, why would they change the robot and have a completely different story, but it's the same name,
And despite all that, they were amazingly successful.
Now, and I've read now, as you know, that the vehicle Voltron was not as successful, which is why they never released the Gladiator Voltron, in the States. But I remember as a kid, that the vehicle Voltron was easily as popular as the Lion Voltron. So I'm not sure what happened, or maybe it was just my perception or something that it was as popular as the Lion Voltron.
See, I don't remember the Vehicle Voltron the first couple of years that Voltron was on the air. I remember, and maybe I watched it, but I don't remember. I remember going on a business trip with my dad when I was a couple of years, a couple of years later, and like on one afternoon, like the Saturday afternoon TV movie that they were playing was that crossover Fleet of Doom. Where
Oh, yeah. That's
the
great.
two Voltrons met. And I remember that was the first time I remember seeing Vehicle Voltron. And I was like, what is this?
No.
There's another Voltron? That was the first I remember seeing Vehicle Voltron was in that movie. I remember very little about the movie, but I was in a ho like a Holiday Inn somewhere. Like a not a not even well maybe not even a Holiday Inn. It wasn't a hotel, it was a motel. And we were watching, Voltron on some Saturday afternoon matinee.
Yeah, the first time I saw Vehicle Voltron, I thought it was Voltes, or Dairuger, I can never remember what they called him, but he was one of the Shogun warriors that turned into that kind of like a train. And he kind of looked similar to Voltron, and at the time I was Showtime was showing a lot of the Shogun warrior cartoons from Japan, that they
Yeah,
had
they were.
cut in. Oh, loved that stuff, man. In fact, I just downloaded the Gai King episodes so that I could rewatch them. while I draw. But they were showing
those. That's the one with the baseball, right? He's a baseball player.
He throws the curveball. That's the big weapon, was the curveball.
So much on Shogun on Showtime was that baseball episode. That was because Guy King was always my favorite.
Well, Guy King. So I had two really close friends, three really close friends when I was that age. And we would play Shogun Warriors. I was always Raiden. Raiden was always my favorite, but they didn't have a cartoon for him, at least not on Showtime. So I had no idea what his powers were. So I just made up a bunch of powers based on what he looked like. But Guy King was my buddy Brian. He was always Guy King. And then, my other buddy was always Grandizer. And then we had another buddy that was always just a generic bad monster. So we would just have these big brawls, you know, as you know, fourth graders out in the middle of the yard, you know.
See, I remember when it came to the toys, because Voltron didn't come out till I was like 15. When I was younger, I did get a 2 foot tall Shogun, though.
Oh, yeah.
I did have that to play with. And, you know, maybe that's why I did like Voltron so much when it came out.
Yeah.
I remember my brother had like a Shogun Warrior size Voltron, and he had a remote control feet, or his feet didn't move, but he had this little platform you could sit him on.
Yeah,
and he could run around the room, and I took that from him. I wish I still had that guy, but yeah, I remember vividly remember going to the toy store with my dad, and they had like on the top shelf were just these rows of boxed up Shogun Warriors, and I got the red one, Dragon.
Dragon, yeah.
And I got him that day, and I was I love those Shogun Warriors.
They were the best.
I don't have Dragon. I have Godzilla. Today I have Godzilla, Guy King, and Mazinga. But
really,
I mean they're all beat up, scratched up. But
so hard to find a decent one.
I still have them. Dragon would be the next one I'd love to get at some point. But
yeah. He was rad because he shot the stars, and the axes, which was cool, you know. And then I always liked Mazinga because he had the one hand that was the three missiles,
right?
So that was cool.
Did you guys remember whether or not you picked up any of the early Voltron toys, and if not, maybe the new versions when Voltron 3D came out, the third dimension came out in the late 90s?
I was given several of the toys that they put out in the late or the mid to late 80s, but I hated them because the toys that they were putting out when Voltron was kind of at its peak popularity were just garbage toys. You know, they just weren't well articulated. They weren't well sculpted. The character, the action figure was too big for the toy, so you put them in the body of the you know, it was just those little inconsistencies that, especially as a kid who was drawing these characters a lot, and you know, because for me, I you know, when I draw, I think about what I'm drawing, right? And so I think about, you know, like well, so Cohen and I was recently kind of having this internal debate. Does Voltron's face move, right?
Right.
Because in the original anime, Golion, Voltron is a sentient being that is then split up into the component parts. And so there is a, in quotes, Voltron character, right? And so even though they never really revisit that character in the anime, to me, that was a motivation as to why they show the Voltron face making faces. You know, sometimes the mouth will be open or whatever. And so the whole time I'm drawing, I'm thinking, I've got to come up with some reason why this face moves. Because in the American version, there's no Voltron character. He is just a robot that's being piloted by these five people.
Right.
And so there's no justification at all for why his face would move. But as an artist, I want to draw expression on his face, right? I want people to be able to read what his internal monologue is, right? So I had to come up with this crazy convoluted idea, because as I was drawing, I would get crazy frustrated, and I'd get mad. I'd be like, well, I can't draw his face doing any, you know, emoting, because there's no reason. So I had to come up with I had to build a justification in my own mind. And then I sent it to Cohen just to make sure that, you know, as a writer, it passed the smell test, you know. And so, you know, so when I was a kid and I would see the toys and they didn't, you know, they weren't proportioned correctly and the characters didn't fit in the head. They fit in the body kind of like a coffin. And, you know, when you put right. them all together, it didn't really look like Voltron. It just disgusted me. I was so done with it, you know.
All right. So, Colin, what was your answer back when you talked about the expressions of Voltron?
I said that his face was made out of the same metal as Destro's mask. I thought Shep came up with a great idea. I just said, yeah, that's great. I'm working that into the, in fact, I don't think you've seen the script for issue, the latest script I turned in, but I started working that in to the script.
Oh, nice.
So,
yeah, the most recent one I have right now is 3.
Oh, okay, yeah. So the next one you get, you'll see I started working your idea in there.
Oh, nice. So that's cool.
So this is pretty cool. We're right still in the middle of developing the whole 6-issue series, right?
We are.
Right. So this is really cool that we're getting you right near, because we're only, by the time this recording gets done and we get this out on the air, it's going to be about 2 weeks to the release of the first issue.
Okay.
So getting you guys, while you're still working on like issues 3, 4, 5, and 6, right? This is pretty cool. So what is it like for you right now compared to what it was like when you started the project?
Well, I mean, I think the book's still pretty close to what I originally envisioned because when I first pitched it, there was obviously no artist attached to it. And really, sometimes you start on these books, you get the artist assigned, and the artist, and you don't really even communicate. I mean, that's a lot of times, especially with, it's different every time, but right. A lot of times you'll get the artist and you get, you know, you start working with the artist and you never even exchange a message with the artist. You don't, you know, the editor acts solely as the go-between and you just don't communicate with them.
Uh-huh.
This is nice only because, one of the things I like about comics is the collaborative nature of it. You know, it's not just me writing a story. It's an artist drawing it. And, and like I said, this was something, it didn't dawn on me. I wasn't worried about how the emotion was going to be drawn. I was like, ah, that's his problem. But I love it when my collaborators and I can talk about these things, you know, these things that come up and we can come up with, I don't think what you came up with has really been talked about in any Voltron story before.
Oh yeah.
So I've never seen it addressed. Yeah, so this is adding to, you know, the mythology of Voltron, I guess, in a way.
There have been questions in the past about whether or not Voltron would ever smile.
Well,
you know.
Well, stay tuned. We'll see. I don't want to spoil anything. I like Shep to see the script and see what he thinks. But
yeah, I'm dying, man. I was actually about to rattle Rybant's chain, our editor at Dynamite. I was about to rattle his chain tomorrow to get the next script, just because I want to read the next script, you know?
Right.
I'm nowhere near, you know, those pages, but I just want to know what's going on.
Sure.
So being that this is where you guys are in two separate, you know, places, working on the same project, what's the biggest difficulty for making sure this is the best thing you can put together?
For me, you know, because this is only my second pro gig and it's my first, you know, the Vampirella gig was really just 8 pages in a comic that had 3 other artists, bunch of writers. So I was really just one of the names, you know, kind of in the shuffle. Whereas this one, it's, you know, for better or worse, you know, my name is prominently attached to it. And so I was very interested to try to make it as good as it could be. And part of that, you know, kind of like what Colin was saying, what I find most interesting and most enjoyable about this whole process is working with the writer. Because I'm so new to the industry, I'm very trepidatious about how I go about that process, because I don't, you know, I mean, some of these, like when I found out that Colin was writing Voltron, I was really thrilled, you know, because for me, you know, that was, you know, it was a little bit like getting to work with a rock star, you know, because I, by that time, I was deep into Sixth Gun, and, you know, I had already started reading. And so when, and plus Colin did, some Shadow for Dynamite, and the Shadow is my hands down favorite character of all time. And so I was a huge wow. fan of that. And so the chance to work with him was really cool. And so I attended, I think the first time I met you, Colin, was at Emerald City last year, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I just buzzed his table and introduced myself, you know. But then, you know, it was hard for me because I wanted to keep talking to Colin and keep kind of, you know, asking him questions about, hey, okay, so we're going to work on Voltron. So I was thinking about this and, you know, but I didn't know to what degree that is acceptable. And I can be a pretty forward leaning guy. I still have a little bit of the army thing in me. So I try to be really cognizant of not being too, you know, overbearing.
Right.
And so, but what Colin's been really cool about it and has been very forthcoming with, you know, like if I have a question, he's real cool about answering it. And so what I'm afraid of is that I'm kind of getting spoiled, you know, like my next project, I'll get paired up with some writer that just doesn't want to deal with it, you know, has no time for the artist, you know.
Would you leave me alone already?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That is the case. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You've been ruined now by working yep. with me.
Once you go Colin, you never go back.
That's right.
All right, so Colin, what is the most difficult thing for you to make sure that you put the best product out?
You know, how much of the story's been revealed in the solicits for the first issue? I can't remember what we've said. I can't remember if we've revealed what the basic punchline for the idea for the story is.
The log line that I've seen is that they do reveal that it's set in the future. They reveal that there's a new team.
Okay, there we go. That's what I want to make sure that was out there.
This is a new team 200 years after the old team.
Yeah, so that's really the thing that I think I think will end up being the problem for the story. And, you know, this is just having worked in comics long enough, I know that fans of certain properties like their stories a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, that's just nature. You like things, but the way you like it, and change is not always met with open arms. And yeah, we're introducing a new Voltron force. It's going to be, you know, a brand new, you know, team entering this story. Now, yeah, you're going to see the classic Voltron force in action in this story, but we're also going to see that, you know, a storyline that it's 200 years later, and, you know, is going to be introducing a brand new team and sort of a new take on the status quo. It worries me a little bit. I wonder how, you know, my, you know, I wonder how that will be met. You know,
you mean from fans?
Oh yeah.
I've stalked a few different, kind of message boards and Voltron fan groups and that kind of thing. Just to see, you know, like anytime someone posted, hey, they're doing a new Voltron series, you know, and I just read the comments to see, you know, what people are saying. And I'll tell you, I've been surprised insofar as, you know, let's say there were 15 comments on this one particular thread. Only one or two of those comments said anything about, well, I don't have any interest in a new team, you know, and so I hope that the combination of the fact that the new team is cool and that all the members of the new team are compelling and interesting, and the fact that we are giving them, you know, a little taste of the original Voltron force, and then the fact that, you know, we are, you know, this Voltron series, more so than the other Voltron series that Dynamite has done, features a lot of Voltron, you know, which is nice, you know, it's... and so I'm hoping that that combination, those three things will bring readers, you know, easily through that kind of bumpy part of them thinking, oh, there's a new team, you know?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing is, you know, I have to worry. I want to honor the legacy of Voltron. You know, I want to honor what has come before, but I'm not going to tell that story of what's come before. I mean, that's been, you know, I want to tell so I want to do a new story.
Yeah,
right. It's been through the ringer before.
Yeah, so so I'm, you know, I want to tell something, do something a little, you know, a little different while honoring, you know, what has come before, and maybe, you know, who knows, set things up for new stories going forward. You know, this series could very easily set up, you know, a new Voltron mythology.
It right. almost feels like it wants to, you know, at least from my perspective, you know, when I'm reading it, you know, again, because when I'm drawing, I'm thinking, and so I'm extrapolating, you know, where this team would be, you know, 5 years from this point, you know, so once they're really good at it, you know, and they, you know, what this new threat winds up looking like and, you know, that kind of thing. But Mark, to address one other aspect of your question, you know, what's most difficult about this? One thing that really was a challenge for me was when I was first approached with this with the story, you know, my editor at the time at Dynamite said, you know, hey, are you interested in drawing some robots? And I was like, yeah, sure. You know, I love robots, you know? And so she had me send her a few sample pages that I'd already done of a comic that I'm working on with one Mr. Brandon Jerwa. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I drop that name? Let me pick that up. So we'd done a little bit of giant robot work between the two of us, and she liked it. So she put me on the book. And she said, okay, knock out the first few pages of the script. We just want to make sure that you can get Voltron on model and, you know, that kind of thing. And for three pages, normally a page, you know, penciled and inked will take me about a day and a half, a solid day and a half of work. So about 10, 12 hours. It took me easily 4 or 5 days per page, because what I found is I had a really hard time figuring out how to draw Voltron, not just the character of Voltron, but the whole story. I had a hard time finding a style that looked good for Voltron. The style that I had used on my other big robot stuff didn't really cut it. The style that I would use on something more human-based didn't really cut it. And so with the first issue, you'll notice that the first about 8 pages, at least to me, you can tell that I was still casting around trying to figure out what the book was going to look like. And then literally on page 8, it was like someone flipped a switch in my head and I got it. And everything past about page 8 is exactly, you know, how I want it to look, you know, given the limits of my ability and that kind of thing.
Right.
But man, that first 8 pages was murder. Just figuring out, you know, like at one point I thought to myself, I'm going to have to call my editor and tell her I'm not good enough to do this comic. That sucks. But I figured it out, so we're good.
So the doubts sink in and you start thinking, wow, am I really going to be able to do this? And then all of a sudden you get your groove, right?
Right. Well, you know, and because a lot of it was just being scared of the fact that Voltron is, you know, he's a character that a lot of people know and love, you know, and I know him and love him, you know. And so it was very important to me that I capture him in a way that is familiar to fans, but also scratches my own itch for doing something interesting, you know?
Yeah, and you had just recently posted on Twitter about, like, the 3 rules of doing comics with publishers.
Yeah.
Can you tell everybody those 3 rules?
Yeah, so when I first started trying to get into comics, I went to the San Diego Comic Convention in 2008, the first year just to kind of observe. And see how the portfolio process worked, right? So then in 2009, I took a portfolio that was loaded with, I want to say, 8 or 9 pages of sequential garbage. And I showed it to several editors. I went through the whole process, and I actually wound up getting a little gig out of it, just a cover for a novel that got released. But some of my pages were Micronauts pages. And so one of the editors that I was talking to said, man, you really should show these to Michael Golden. I think he'd really like them. Now, Michael Golden, the artist for the Micronauts, is a legit comic legend, right? He's the guy that made me an artist. If I owe anybody money for biting off their style, it's, mm-hmm. it's Michael Golden. I should be paying that guy royalties.
Okay.
He's also known to be a fairly blunt dude and a kind of a painfully honest guy. And so I was like, man, there is no chance I'm showing him these pages, you know, but the editor kind of talked me into it. So I took my pages to Michael Golden, and much to my surprise and pleasure, he was super cool about it. And it was the first time I'd met him, and I got to have essentially a 30-minute conversation about the Micronauts with the guy who was kind of my artistic father, you know what I mean? And you know, he gave me one of the two really salient pieces of advice that brought my art to the next level and made me kind of pro level worthy. But at the end of it, he said, look, I got three rules for you for how to get into the comic industry and stay in the comic industry. And I was like, all right, let's hear it. And he said, the first rule is be fast and hit your deadlines. The second rule is be cool and be easy to work with. Take editorial direction well. And the third rule is be good at drawing, in that order.
Yeah.
And that made a lot of sense to me, you know, and I've told everybody that I've spoken with who's expressed an interest in getting into comics that those are the rules, because, you know, I'll try to be brief. You know, the idea is, you know, let's say you got 100 people showing up and they all want to get a job drawing comics. Well, you can chop that 100 people down by 50, because they just don't really know what it's like to sit at a comic at a art board for 12 hours and work on one single thing, you know. So that stick-to-itiveness is not common, so you can immediately chop half of those people out. And then there's another half that you can chop away because they're just not fast enough. And then another half that you can chop away because they're just not good enough. And then another half, you know what I mean? And you can keep whittling this number down, and then eventually the way that the number gets whittled down farther, you've got people that are fast enough and good enough and can sit at a desk for 12 hours, but they're, you know, hard to work with. They don't... You know, they're not easy for the editor to deal with. And it's like Michael Golden said, he said, there are two kinds of artists in the world, the kind of artist that makes their editor's lives easier and the kind of artist that makes their editor's lives harder. And he goes, and you don't want to be that guy. And he's absolutely right. You know, I mean, every editor that I've spoken with or worked with to this point, that is money in their pocket, is as long as you hit your deadlines and don't give them a bunch of crap to deal with, you'll keep getting work.
Right. And I'm going to drop a few names here too, because I've actually sat next to artists at conventions and I've seen them do their work really quick. And I've seen guys like Jacob Shabbat. I've seen Scott Derby, Dave Perillo, Tom Whalen. These guys have had some pretty successful work out there. And the reason they're able to keep doing the work and keep churning it out is because at these conventions, they'll do like little $20 to $25 drawings, and they'll get them done within 15 minutes.
Right.
You know, and by doing that as a practice all the time, I'm sure that really helps you with doing comic books.
Yeah. Chuck Jones said the ability to be a cartoonist is to draw quickly and with authority. And I always really liked that quote. Colin, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, I agree with all the advice Mr. Golden gave you, because it's very pertinent. I think, I don't know, a while back I got into some hot water because I was posting my advice to, you know, would-be creators. And I think I said somewhere along the lines, I said something that struck some people that I was saying that doing comics was not art. And that the people who wanted to do art, that saw comics as art got very upset with me. And listen, you know, if you want to... If you want to make comics, I don't care what reason you have. If you want to make comics as art, by God, do it. You know, and if you want to take 10 years to do a single issue, then that is awesome. Go for it. If you want to work for solely yourself, do it however you want to do it. If you're not worried about money, if you want to do it as a living, if you want to work for Marvel or DC or Dynamite or any of these companies that are out there, if you want to do that, then you've got to start looking at it as work and as a business.
Yeah, it's a vocation. It's not, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, when I was still in the process of trying to land a gig and get my game together, I was talking to my wife and you know, she said, well, honey, you just got to keep working at it because you want to be a comic book artist. And I said, you know what, to be honest, if my current level of dedication and output is any indication, I don't want to be a comic book artist because I'm not working it like a job. I'm being a flighty artist. I'm drawing for 3 or 4 hours a day, and I'm drawing what I want to draw. And if I don't feel like drawing it, I don't. And then I go and I get lunch. And that's not how you do it. You know, you gotta be willing to sit down at the desk and either write or draw or whatever it is that you're going to do, ink or letter, and be willing to do it and relinquish your preciousness about it. You can't be precious, you know, because it might get cut or it's going to get changed or it might not be something you're terribly passionate about. And you have to approach it like a craftsman, you know, like I'm going to hammer this page out because I've got the next guy in line waiting for the page. You know, the colorist needs to get his job done. The letterer needs to get his job done or her job done, you know?
And you also have to be willing to work over the same type of material like 30 to 100 times before it's right.
Oh, Yeah.
I know what that was like, because when I did the Voltron book, I was working with the editor, Tracy Todd from Viz Media, and it wasn't 5 times. It wasn't 10 times. It was more like 40 times.
Right. Yeah, I, as an artist, you know, I wind up drawing the same page at least 3 times. You know, I drew the first page as thumbnails, just really rough, you know, breakdown drawing, to make sure the editor, you know, approves of my storytelling, and then I do it in pencils, and then I do it again in inks, you know, and so it's, you know, I mean, like I said, one page can take me a really long time because, you know, I'm not just drawing it once, you know, I'm having to draw. And each time I draw it, some new level of detail gets added or some new twist, you know, until eventually the final page looks almost completely unrecognizable to the beginning page. You know, there's still, it's the same content, but just the level of detail and craftsmanship is night and day, you know?
Okay. So I want to talk to you guys specifically about Voltron from the Ashes, and I want to ask a question that I don't know if your editors from Dynamite are going to be happy about, but tell us what you can about this storyline, and I'll start with Colin. Tell us what you can about this without getting your editors upset, because this does come out in 2 weeks, and obviously you can't tell us the whole story, and we don't want to know the whole story because we want to be surprised. We don't want to be spoiled. So what can you tell us about this without going over the line?
All right, let's see. So 200 years ago, Voltron faced its greatest, you know, the Voltron force faced its greatest battle. And Voltron basically you know, made its last stand, the robot, against a number of enemies. And in this battle, while Voltron came out triumphant, it was also, the robot was so damaged that it basically collapsed, you know, where it stood and seized up. And over in the years that have followed, Voltron's become sort of this monument that still stands where it fell. And, you know, these people have this almost monastic society has risen up in the shadow of Voltron. And has taken to training people for the day that Voltron might one day, you know, be needed again.
Wow.
and this story basically follows, you know, the day is coming that Voltron is needed again. An enemy from its past, from the past, has is rising once more. And the story follows, you know, these monks have been training these 5 different teams to see who could be worthy to pilot Voltron if it were ever needed again. And this is something that's been going on for centuries now, you know, decades and decades of different teams being trained.
So these monks, they're like the keepers of the Grail, right?
Right, right.
Okay.
And so now Voltron is needed again. A team has been chosen that is the most worthy team. They are the perfect group, a well-oiled machine that will pilot Voltron perfectly. Will be the greatest Voltron team ever. And this may be where we spoil something. they get destroyed, and the team that has to the team that has to pilot Voltron is not the best team for the job.
Okay, so this is sort of like the '93 Phillies then come together, scrap together.
I was gonna say it's Bad News Bears. Yeah. Pilot. You know,
I'm thinking of the '93 Phillies because I'm from Philly, so they were the team that that you would have never thought that they were a well-oiled machine, but they were in first place the whole season and went to the went to the World Series and then lost in that. But okay. I see that.
Yeah. So there you go. I may have spoiled a little bit, but not enough. That's going to hurt anything. The story's still there to enjoy.
Yeah. It's intact.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So in thinking about all this, of course, you think about all these people over 200 years that have been training to be there in case Voltron is needed. And of course, they sacrifice their whole lives training for that and then don't ever do it. How does that imagine being one of those people?
You know, what's funny is one of the characters of the new team actually expresses that as a frustration more than once. You know, he keeps saying, dude, we haven't needed Voltron for 200 years. We're not, you know, there's nothing out there. You know, everything's, you know, this is all just a kind of a waste of time, you know, which is kind of, I think, to your point, a natural kind of evolution of the attitude that would happen. You know, it's like, okay, look, we've been training for this for 200 years. You know, it's like that's the length of the nation's history. There's nothing's going on. You know, what are we training for?
Yeah, right. And really, that's the team leader that feels that way. That like this is all pointless. No one has. Everybody who's trained before us was not needed. They did it for nothing. And
well, who is their mentor that tells them how important this really is?
The monks.
Yeah, there's this group, okay. and they have a pretty interesting connection to Voltron that I will not spoil.
Know that one yet.
Yeah, but you know, they know how important it is, and you know, and even the monks, you know, to this point, you know, there's probably doubt in that group as well that hey, you know, we've been serving faithfully for, you know, the day that Voltron will be needed. He's never been needed. There's a little story there of, you know, of some things you have to believe in when there's no proof that you have to believe, you know, and that's really what this guy, you know, our leader character is kind of, you know, struggling with is he just can't accept it anymore. And that's part of why he's probably not the first choice to lead, you know, to lead the Voltron Force.
That's the exact feeling that I got from reading the script is the biggest challenge for that character is just the chip on his shoulder. Everything else he's got, he's just got this chip on his shoulder that's holding him back.
Right. Right. So in doing this story and everything, do you make references back to King Alphor and the original team?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I mean the original. Yeah. All yeah. Right. No. So you'll be seeing lots of callbacks to Voltron's history.
OK, that's good. What did you use as your reference material, your research material for the original stuff and the history of Voltron?
I'll be honest. I did a little bit of research on it, but I really just took it in the direction I thought. You know, I kind of told my version of some of that stuff. So I winged it a little bit.
Okay.
I did enough research to make me dangerous. And honestly, that's what I do with. I do it with every, you know, I write a lot of comics that have a lot of, you know, the characters have vast histories that I was not part of creating. You know, when I'm writing the X-Men or Deadpool or any of those, you know, or the Green Lantern stories that I'm writing, things like that, there's, you know, years and years of history that I wasn't there. And my job is to honor that history, but not to be so beholden to it that I cripple the story.
Right. You can be too slavish to canon to the degree where the story becomes rote and predictable.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's something we want to distinguish for the people listening to this podcast, as well as the people who will be reading these comics that you guys made, is that every time a new person works on a Voltron story, they're not beholden to that original history, that they can slightly alter that history in ways that make the story even better.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me about the history, and actually, Cullen, you're probably going to get a much too long email from me in the next day or so about this. But I've been thinking a lot about the history. So in, I think about what I'm drawing. And so I've been watching the old Go Lion, the Japanese, the dubbed stuff. Right. And mm-hmm. it's a very different story, very different story. And so I've been thinking about, you know, well, wait a minute. In my brain, I want to link the American version of Voltron and Go Lion, right? And so I've built in my mind a history of the planet Eris, which was, you know, essentially Eris used to be called Altea, right? And right after Voltron was essentially broken up by the Queen of the Universe, she now, so in my brain, I created this mythology where there are these beings called the First Ones, and there's like six or seven of them, and they're essentially the gods that created all of reality. And they dream and think reality into existence, right? And they don't have any concepts or notions of good and evil. It's just creation, right? But one of these First Ones falls kind of in love with our universe, and as the First Ones continue to dream and think, chaos arises, and not everything that they dream and think is good or you know, conducive to life. And so what happens is some of these things start to attack the universes that they're dreaming into existence. Well, one of these First Ones doesn't want this particular universe harmed, and so he gives up his godhood essentially, and thinks himself into existence as Voltron, the defender of the universe. And this is ancient universal history. And so he doesn't look like a robot. He looks like this organic being that is, you know, Voltron. And so he defends the universe for so long that he forgets what it was about the universe that he loved, and he forgets what it was about this reality that he abandoned his godhood for. So he wants to become a god again, at which point the Queen of the Universe comes and tries to remind him what he loved about it, but he's enraged and he won't listen, so she breaks him up into the five components. She sends those five components to the planet Altea as dreams, right? And basically, this planet is like our version of Atlantis. It was filled with, you know, philosophers and scientists and artists, and they had this kind of utopia going. And so she sends these five dreams to these philosophers and artists and scientists, and they are inspired to create the five lions. They build these five lions. And they name it Go Lion, because in their language, like, lions are a mythical creature to their society. They don't have lions. And so Go, the Japanese word for five is Go. That's where Go mm-hmm. Lion comes from. But I'm just going to have it that their language, Go Lion, is what they name this thing. And they refer to it as Go Lion. So the first invasion of Daibazar, or whatever that guy's name is. Daibazal, yeah. That invasion happens, and Voltron manages to defeat the invasion, but it essentially decimates Altean society, right? And Altean society never really recovers. And Voltron, you know, the team that pilots Voltron, they all, you know, fade into obscurity and die. The lions go dormant, you know, and over thousands of years, the planet becomes known as Eris. And, you know, essentially a new, you know, the Drool Armada comes to attack Eris. And so Voltron is used again, you know, and they, you know, and so that becomes the kind of the second phase. It's my way in my own brain of linking the two, you know, mythologies, so that I in my own brain have a sense of kind of through line for the story. Okay. You'll have to edit all of that out, because I have to assume I'm the only one interested in any of it.
No. There's a lot of people who have thought about what happens if we combine what they did with Voltron for the American version and what they did with Go Lion from the Japanese version and try to meld them together into one story and then take a new story and put that on top of that.
Right. And that's kind of what I feel like From the Ashes is, you know, it's kind of like part three, you know?
Right. Colin, do you feel like that's what you've done?
I don't know if we, you know, I think it's, I'm not 100% convinced that, From the Ashes is the story that links everything perfectly. I think it, okay. I think it sets up the potential to link those things in the future. And you know, if From the Ashes is successful and well received, then I think it opens the doorway for us to do more of those kinds of you know, those kinds of stories.
Yeah. Do you guys remember the end of the first Avengers movie with Sam Jackson?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. So one of his last lines in the movie is where Hill asks him, what makes you think they're going to come back together again as the Avengers? And he says, because we'll need them to.
Right.
And that reminded me a lot of what happens when the five lions come together as Voltron, because we need them to.
Well, that's a trope that you'll find is really common in a lot of Japanese fiction. You know, I mean, it started with, you know, at least for me, I don't know if you guys remember, there used to be an old black and white giant robot show. I think he was called Goldar.
Oh, wow. Wow. Remember that? I do remember Goldar. Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was the same kind of deal. You know, he always comes back because we need him, you know. And then, you know, after the first Godzilla movie where, you know, Godzilla was a different thing. But once they started making sequels, it was always, you know, Godzilla will come back when we need him, you know. And then same with kind of the Shogun Warriors, a lot of the different anime that they did of the Shogun Warriors, like the Gai King or the Grandizer, it was always, you know, at the end of the show, it was, that was the sentiment that came out. Well, he'll return when we need him. You know, it's, I think it's very much a, the Japanese have a saying, it's a ganbatte kudasai, which means essentially keep fighting, you know, fight on, you know? Right. And I think it's very much their way of encapsulating that spirit into their fiction.
That there will always be this evil force that tries to, you know, take away from the rest of the universe, and that's why we need Voltron.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
We've gone through things that you can say about it without going over the line to spoil people. Now I want to go over some of the things that have been done with Voltron before that we've talked about the third dimension. In the third dimension, they actually talk about the Voltron lions being sentient and, you know, responding to Allura's calls and things like that. And mm-hmm. Allura herself having this royal connection to the lions. And then in Voltron Force, the cartoon that came out that also had a comic book associated with it, where they had three cadets that were coming together to help form a new team. And that was the first time that people had ever, you know, seen not just the original characters, but new team members coming on as well.
Right.
How did those two things, you know, come into, you know, did you think about those things at all when you came into this story, or were you completely fresh going into this story, Colin?
You know, I thought about them, but I wanted this to serve more as a sort of like a sequel to the original series than so I didn't really include a lot of those elements from those from the other versions. I know Voltron Force, that one really changed the lions up quite a bit too. I mean, each of the lions had like a distinct look. They were different. They had different weapons, and I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, was that Voltron Force? Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that the one where they could switch out being the central torso? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not that. It's not that okay. version. And these are, you know, I really stuck closer to the classic depiction of Voltron. I wanted to see, you know, I wanted to see the five lions. I wanted them to have the weapons that I remember him having when I was a kid. You might see a little bit of new stuff, but for the most part, you know, there's Voltron and he's awesome. And you know, as we said earlier, this is a comic that has a lot of Voltron in it. But at the same time, he really serves as this as the vehicle for these characters, and really it's about the, you know, it's about the characters as much as it is about Voltron. So I didn't want to really shake things up too much in terms of this being some new version of Voltron or something we haven't seen before. This is the Voltron that, you know, from that original cartoon series, and it takes it, you know, from that.
Okay. So, we also know that a lot of the people that listen to the podcast and a lot of fans of Voltron over the years, they've read the comics, they've seen the TV shows, the cartoons, they've bought the merchandise. What they're all waiting for is a live action Voltron film. What are your guys' thoughts on
that?
Me
too.
You know, I think it would be awesome. I think it could be super great. I've lived in St. Louis for a long time and never realized that what's the name of the company?
World Events Productions.
Yeah, that world for years. I didn't,
leave it to the guy that runs the Let's Voltron podcast and just pull that out.
You know, I did not know for years that World Event Productions was here in St. Louis, and then found out, you know, through a friend of a friend, I knew someone that worked for WEP, and you know, I went to their offices, which was awesome. You know, this was years ago. You know,
yes,
before I was really doing much in terms. I mean, I'd done a couple of creator-owned stuff, but I still had a day job at the time that I did this, and you know, got to go into their offices and see the giant Voltron statue in the lobby and all the, you know, all those cool things. And they were talking even back then. You know, they were discussing the. Well, they were discussing Voltron Force at the time. They were planning on Voltron Force, but then they were also talking about the live action movie. You know, people who were putting the live action movie together and stuff like that. And it was all really exciting. But you know, it could be great. It's just a matter of doing it right. You know.
Did you actually get to go to the St. Louis Science Center while that even taller statue of Voltron was there?
I was not. No, I did not.
Oh. Oh wow, that would have been cool to see that in person.
Yeah.
At San Diego this year, and I'm sure you've seen it, Mark. There, I posted a few pictures on Twitter. They had a few different versions of Voltron that are being released. There was a Five Lions kind of a die-cast metal, you know, version that is a slight redesign. It's basically the classic design, but just kind of slightly updated. But they had this maquette that was, I want to say it was like 3 feet tall. It was unpainted.
It was 27 inches with the base, and that's from Sideshow Collectibles.
Yeah, and it was the coolest thing I've seen, man. I took probably 30 pictures of the thing. And the whole time that I was looking at it, I thought, if there's going to be a cinematic Voltron, this has got to be, you know, the direction that they're going to use for the design. Because it was just such a compelling design.
Right. That statue, which will be coming out, and it could be upwards of $2,000.
Yeah, it's big, man.
It's very big, and it's going to be, you know, one of the best collectibles that Sideshow has ever done. But they did tell us that this is their designer's version of it, not anything based on an actual live action movie.
Yeah, no. I don't. Yeah, exactly. It's not what they're going to use in any movie, but it's any cinematic version of Voltron has got to take that as its cue. The design was just amazing. It's just one of the most. Colin, I'm sure you saw it while you were there.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
I could have actually seen you guys in San Diego, and I didn't even realize that.
Well, because you know, I'm still pretty hyped about, you know, being in the whole comics thing. I actually was trying to nail Colin down, you know, to sit down and have a drink just so that we could nerd out about Voltron. And so we bumped into each other two or three times over the course of San Diego, but it was always, you know, he was going somewhere, or I was going somewhere, or whatever. And then at one point I bumped into him on the street, and he's such a gracious guy. Colin's a really gracious dude. He's like, yeah, man, let me try to figure out when we can get this together. And he pulls out this piece of paper that's just got like crazy scribbles over the whole thing. And I realize, I'm like, oh, he's actually here doing business and like taking care of things, you know?
It was the most miserable trip to San Diego I've ever had. I mean, I did not have 10 minutes to see anything at the convention. When I saw that Voltron at Sideshow, it's because Sideshow was in between the Oni press booth and the DC booth, and I would cross that way to get from one to the other or something. So it was, yeah, I saw nothing in San Diego. It was just I had something going on every second.
Yeah.
Of every day. So yeah, it was tough. And it's funny when you bumped into me on the street was the one time I wasn't doing business, you know, I wasn't attending business. I was waiting. My wife is a big fan of this TV show, Impractical Jokers. And I'm friends with one of the guys on the show, and I was waiting to meet him to go in, you know, to sneak back around back to go, into there. They were doing a big signing, at one of the galleries, and I was waiting to meet him to sneak back there so I could pick up like a comic book that my wife really wanted. that was I had like an hour and a half of free time, and I went and I did that for her to get her a comic when I left. Yeah, it was a miserable convention only because I was going constantly.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I came to the realization kind of then. I was like, oh, man, this convention really, especially for anybody that's a pro, this convention really is not something that you go to enjoy. It's, you know, it's all business, you know. I mean, even the really low level of business that I was doing, it, you know, I was there with two of my friends. I go every year with two of my friends, and you know, more times than I would have liked, I had to tell them, hey guys, I got to split, man, I got to go talk to this guy, I'll be back in an hour, you know, and then we'd have to do the whole cell phone meetup thing, and you know.
People aren't just there to promote their wares and their current projects and stuff like that. They're there to set up future projects, and there's $1 million contracts being written at the beginning, at least, of San Diego. So
not for any comic artists. I don't know who they're paying with that, but
I mean for the TV shows and movies.
It's a crazy
convention. Next year when I go, I've vowed that I will not be doing any of that. If I go next year, I'm gonna go with 80% leisure time.
Yeah,
and 20% business time, not 100% business. That's what I say anyway, but I've said that for the past few years.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, right. it may be of interest, because this is interesting to me.
Okay.
We talk about this years ago, when I had first met the guys at WEP, one of them put me in touch with this guy from Toynami, who I guess, and you know, you may even know better than I do, he owns the rights to all these different Shogun Warriors, and basically he put me in touch with him and said, I want you to meet with him at San Diego. So this was before.
That's George Son.
Yeah, George. Yeah. So I met with George years ago, and I think I had maybe 15 minutes of his time. This was in San Diego before I had really broken in a big, significant way. And George told me, he said, I want to do a comic, but I want to do all the Shogun Warriors and Voltron. And I want to figure out a reason that keeps all their stories intact, keeps every, you know, all the individual histories of all the Shogun Warriors and Voltron intact, not changing anything, but brings a reason for them to all come together.
That sounds great.
Yeah, that's right? Manna to my soul.
You hear that from Chef. He's like, oh, that's the way I was at the moment. I mean, I came back home and I put all these, you know, and this, you know, those kind of things always fall, you know, more frequently than not, they fall apart. But for, you know, for a while, I was putting all these plans together, and I was coming up with these, you know, how all these Shogun Warriors would function in the same universe and everything. And I, you know, that was probably my first ever, what I consider my first big meeting, you know, in San Diego, was all about Voltron and the Shogun Warriors.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And one thing that George has with Toynami is he's got licenses from DreamWorks to be able to make those collectibles that he makes for Voltron. But he doesn't own Voltron. World Events Production owns Voltron. But he is the complete owner and licensor of Shogun Warriors.
Right.
Wow. So those new Shogun Warriors, those are his his, because they've got a new breed of Shogun Warriors out there that, to be honest, I wasn't terribly impressed with the designs, but it was nice to see the logo, you know, it was nice to know that they're pressing forward, but I haven't seen anything other than the display at San Diego. Right. I haven't noticed anything, you know, being released online about it.
But I, you know, I can't wait to see what he comes up with.
Yeah, I did. So does anybody have the comic license for Shogun Warriors right now?
Well, if it was going to come from him, he would have to, you know, take either Dynamite or, you know, one of these other comics publishers, and he would have to give the license to them for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I haven't heard that yet.
I don't know if they do or not. Even back then, and again, this was several years ago, he had told me that there were a couple that he was talking to about licensing it. But he, you know, he is, to his credit, he's one of those guys that's like, if I do it, I'm not going to do it unless it's going to be my vision of what I want with these characters. You know, he was, he is, you know, he's not just a guy who produces these toys. He loves them. You know, he loves these characters.
I don't know if you guys heard it or not, but I had done my interview with him from San Diego. And you can just hear the passion that he has for all these.
That's one of your podcasts?
Yes.
Look for it again.
If you go back, I did a short little video, and it's on Let's Voltron YouTube, where we actually did a walkthrough of his booth. And then following that, we went inside his booth, and we actually did a full long podcast interview.
Oh,
that's
nice.
That's one of our episodes for the podcast. So I would encourage you to go back and do that, because you really feel the passion this man has for the toys and for the properties, you know, based on growing up as a kid, you know, in front of all those robots.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool to hear when someone, you know, is taking the stewardship of those characters, you know, seriously. You know, there's a handful of characters that I would wrestle two grown men to the ground to draw. You know, I mean, the Micronauts, Rom, both of which IDW has recently relaunched, which is rad. The Shadow, you know, Flash Gordon, a lot of Dynamite properties, which is one of the reasons I was so drawn to Dynamite. But the Shogun Warriors have always been kind of, you know, between it basically it's the Shogun Warriors and the Micronauts. Those are my two, man, I want to draw those so bad. And I, you know, hopefully George, will be able to work out, you know, a comic deal for the Shogun Warriors. And then, you know, who knows, maybe some writer and I can, figure out a pitch for it.
well, from the Ashes, from Dynamite, I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that Alex Milne did the cover.
Yes. The amazingly talented Alex Milne.
He has also worked with Transformers as well, right?
Yeah, that's his bread and butter. He is known as the Transformers guy, and for good reason. His Transformers work is untouched.
Now, is he going to be doing every cover, or just the first cover, or
no? He's doing all six covers. I've seen up to the third cover, and they're great. They're just amazing. My favorite one so far is the second cover.
That's crazy, 'cause I don't know that I've seen them.
Oh, you haven't?
Except the first. So I'll go rattle some cages. I'd love to, you know, yeah. But
they're great.
Drawing robots, by the way, is a special kind of talent. And it's not robots. I know a lot of artists who would very quickly run away screaming, you know, from the idea of drawing robots.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of detail involved?
Yeah, it's the detail. You know, robots don't change shape. I mean.
Right.
But robots are always the same design. They're always, you know, you have to build action into these, you know, these characters who are not, you know, you don't think of robots as being, you know, action driven. I mean, listen, there's a lot of artists who, you know, I've got pitches out there for, you know, stories that involve a lot of cars and trucks, and artists don't want to draw cars. A lot of artists don't want to draw cars and trucks because they're a pain. So I in my mind, I'm guessing that robots just take that to the, you know, to the nth degree.
A big problem with drawing robots is that because they don't have humanoid anatomy, You know, even though they are roughly humanoid, they've got legs and arms or whatever. But often, like with Voltron, as soon as you get to Voltron's waist, he just loses all semblance of reality. Like, there's no way he could actually function with hips like he's got. So, right. Man, the liberties I take with physics just to make him, you know, look like he could walk, you know, are just ridiculous, you know. And then his feet are so big and so outsized compared to the rest of his body and the whole nine. And so it all looks cool. It's a really cool visual language. But as an artist, you know, especially an artist with a strong background in anatomy and, you know, the human form, you know, I'll draw something five times because I keep wanting to draw it like a person. And you know, Voltron doesn't sit that way, or his arm doesn't move that far to the left, or, you know, those kind of weird little things that just make the process of drawing a robot one added layer of, you know, kind of quality control. You got to always check, are my lines straight? Am I, you know, have I fudged anything? You know, it's, and, you know, an artistic device like crosshatching that looks great on, say, a person doesn't work on a metal surface. You have to give it that kind of brushed metal look, you know. So it's, there's a lot of technique that goes into drawing a robot that is not present when you're drawing, you know, an X-Man or Cyclops or whomever, you know.
Right. Right. When it comes to getting, like, the first issue out, the second issue out, the third issue out, and all that kind of stuff, do we know what the schedule is for the releases of each of these issues?
I don't. I'm guessing it's roughly a month after the first one. I mean, whatever the release date is, about a month later.
Yeah, that would be my guess. Is, you know, if the first one's out on September 16th, then, you know, the next one will be out October 16th ish. You know, whatever that Wednesday is. You know.
Yeah, I just know that some of the fans that had commented on this in the past had mentioned that they would appreciate if Dynamite gets them on a regular schedule of each release. And I just don't know if that's a normal thing for comic book releases.
If a comic slips, you can almost always blame the artist. The writers tend to get their work in on time, and, you know, the work doesn't even start on the issue. You know, the long work doesn't start on the issue until the artist hits it. You know, and so if a title slips, I'd say conservatively 95% of the time it's the artist's fault.
Okay.
Now, I'm doing my best to try to make sure I don't slip for one reason only. Because this is my first big gig with Dynamite, if I miss a deadline, the chances of me working for Dynamite again are pretty slim.
Right.
And I really want to work for Dynamite again because, like I said, I'm such a big fan of so many of their properties. I could very easily, you know, and happily work for Dynamite for the next couple of years and not blink an eye, you know,
wow.
And be completely happy in what I was doing. So I really want to, you know, safeguard that relationship, which means getting my work in on time. So, you know, if something slips, you can probably blame me for it, but I'm going to work very hard not to let anything slip.
Okay. Is there anybody that you've worked with at Dynamite or in this whole process that you want to thank for giving you the opportunity to do this project?
Well, since I'm the new guy, I'll go first because, you know, Colin, I'm sure, has a completely different set of gratitudes. But for me, I first have to thank Michael Golden for giving me, like I said, I got two pieces. I showed my portfolio to conservatively 55 million editors and artists.
Wow.
And that's a conservative number. And I'll tell you, I only got two pieces of really useful feedback. Because most of the artists, my style is not a very mainstream style. I don't look like Jim Lee. I don't look like, you know, John Romita or any of the big names of comics. I have a fairly unique style. Most of the editors that I spoke to were essentially giving me the advice I needed if I wanted to be the next Jim Lee. And my point was that I don't want to be the next Jim Lee. I want to be the first Blackie Shepherd. That's kind of what I'm doing here, you know.
Right.
And so Michael Golden gave me my first piece of useful advice, which was basically I need to do a lot more shading. I had my work was really flat. And then a writer, a wonderful writer who I'm a big fan of, and he's become kind of a buddy of mine, is a guy named Eric Troutman, who's written a lot for Dynamite, and he's done some DC work and that kind of thing. But he gave me a piece of advice. Just, it was a weird little blind spot that had been in my art for literally my entire life. And he was looking at my stuff and he goes, you don't do your eyes right. And as soon as he pointed out, I'm like, oh, whoa, check that out. I've been making this mistake my entire life, you know.
Wow.
And so those two pieces of advice really cemented my ability to do pro work. I then have to thank Brandon Jerwa, who I made – when I got back into comics, you know, a few years ago, and I fell in love with the Shadow comic that Dynamite was doing and the Vampirella comic that Dynamite was doing, and Brandon was the writer on Vampirella, and just through this weird series of coincidences, he was friends of a friend of mine. So we became buddies. And he essentially kind of put me in this world. He was friends with the editors at Dynamite. And so when I had a portfolio that was worth looking at, he took it to Molly at Dynamite, and she gave me my Vampirella gig. And then, of course, I have to thank Joe Rybant, the editor at Dynamite, because mm-hmm. he's the guy, you know, he, you know, everything goes through Joe, and he's been super gracious and super cool about, you know, putting up with me being a total cherry new guy, not really knowing what I'm doing. He's been so cool to work with because he's, you know, he's just a cool guy. He's, you know, Joe's just one of them dudes. He's another guy that I just want to hang out and drink a beer with, you know, and tell mm-hmm. stories.
Okay. How about you, Colin?
And Colin. And I have to thank Colin of all time.
Okay.
You know, there are so, if I were thinking just in comics, there are so many people I need to thank. And, you know, I've thanked people publicly many times for, you know, helping me getting into comics. You know, it's definitely, you know, for me, it was, you know, there were a lot of people who helped me, make the big break. But if I'm talking this book with Voltron, you know, I have to take to thank, you know, it's Nick Barucci who, you know, who's the head honcho over at
yeah.
Dynamite.
He's the real daddy at Dynamite. Yeah,
right. He's the guy who got me into all the books I've done for Dynamite. You know, it all comes from, one meeting at Emerald City a couple of years ago. Where he came and said, you know, I want to meet with you tomorrow. And then he came and said, here's, you know, six books I want you to do for us. You know, one of which being Voltron. And, it was him that got me into, you know, working with Dynamite and working on this book. So definitely him, you know, Joe obviously is great. And Molly, who is no longer with Dynamite, but was with Dynamite at the time I took these projects, you know, all of them, deserve my thanks, and, you know, for this at least.
Okay, that's great. I want to give you guys a chance to plug your latest thing other than Voltron from the Ashes. Is there anything else you want to plug that you've either done or are doing?
Well, I've just got Voltron, so this is Colin's game.
Right.
Well, you know, I've got a book called Harrow County coming out right now from Dark Horse. We talked about it earlier. That's, you know, coming out right now. I also do a book called The Sixth Gun for Oni Press, which will be coming to its end soon. But you can check that series out if you're into, you know, epic supernatural storylines.
Yeah, it's great. Sixth Gun is great.
You know, and right now, you can pre-order. I've got a new book coming out in October called Blood Feud, that you could pre-order, right now, and make sure you tell it's also from Oni Press, sort of a, you know, I've been describing it. It's another, rural horror story. I've been describing it as Hatfields and McCoys if the Hatfields were, you know, demon worshiping sorcerers. It's coming out, like I said, the first issue of that comes out in October. You can pre-order it right now. It's called Blood Feud. I'm launching Uncanny X-Men. I'll be launching in December. I'm working on a lot of new things right now.
Yeah. And then I'm also reading, something that, that Cullen's putting out called Hellbreak. That's really good with Brian Chirilla. Is that how you pronounce his name, Chirilla?
Chirilla, yeah, yeah. It's coming out right. That also is another book from Oni Press right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can get the down low on all my books. Hey, I put a lot of books out right now. I'm working on a lot of projects. But if you go to my website, which is CullenBunn.com, you can pretty much see all the books I have worked on or am working on or will be working on and that have been announced in the future.
Okay, so you're also available on Twitter at Cullen Bunn. That's
yes.
CullenBunn.
Yes.
And also on Facebook, facebook.com/Cullen Bunn.
Yep.
And then Blackie, you've got your own website, www.cqshep.com.
That's my portfolio site, yeah.
Right. And then you're also on Twitter at CQShep. That's CQSHEP.
Yep.
And you're also on DeviantArt as ArtDevil313.
Yep. Although I haven't messed with my DeviantArt in the longest time. The best place to find me is probably the Facebook, which is facebook.com/CQShep.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both for joining me here on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. Would you guys be able to come back again and talk about these after issues are out and then at the end when all six issues are out?
I'm happy to, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because one thing that we want to gauge is also, you know, obviously the fans are going to start getting their hands on these and they're going to read them and they're going to, you know, they may have questions.
Yeah,
so
sure.
At that point, we also want to bring the fans in and have them the opportunity to ask you guys questions on the podcast. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Great. All right. So we'll get together over email and we'll start talking about scheduling those in.
Yeah, all right. That's good.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining me on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, and we'll talk to you next time on
Let's Voltron.